You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 26th of May to the 1st of June 2016. My name is John Elms and I'm joined by reporters Chris Havergal, David Matthews and Matthew Rice. In the news this week, can the NSS data be trusted amid claims of cheating? That's the quite bold headline of our splash this week. Allegations of inappropriate influence have emerged on what's likely to be a key teaching excellence framework metric. Chris Havergal has the story there. In other news, Unpredictable Currents, our cover feature this week. David Matthews has been investigating China amid warnings of an over-reliance on students from the Middle Kingdom. And with no new China in view, he has considered the threats to the burgeoning tide of arrivals and whether the West can shockproof its institutions while keeping the conveyor belt rolling. And Matthew will be taking the role on reporting two contributors to our features section on academics living with physical frailty and what that means for their academic legacy. But first, Chris, you've been investigating the NSS and some irregularity, shall we say, in that.
Yeah, the NSS, the National Student Survey, is likely to become ever more important in coming years, with it being earmarked as a proposed metric for the Teaching Excellence Framework. Ultimately, the results that are given in the NSS could have an impact on the tuition fees that an institution is allowed to charge. Therefore, the reliability of that data is key. What my article in this week's magazine does is explore allegations of inappropriate influence exerted by institutions on their students while filling in the NSS. That can be quite a broad definition, but it basically means trying to encourage students to give an impression of their course or time at university that is, you know, not true. And the findings are that the Higher Education Funding Council for England, which coordinates the questionnaire across the UK, has investigated claims that institutional staff have tried to get undergraduates to inflate their course ratings on 30 occasions over the last 7 years. It doesn't sound like a massive number, but I think what's perhaps interesting is that there is some evidence that the frequency of reporting is on the rise. All but 12 of those complaints have been lodged in the last 2 years. Mm. And also, speaking to researchers about findings, they say that this is most likely a snapshot of a wider problem. I mean, in terms of what the actual allegations are, you know, what the inappropriate influence was, in most cases it's found to be some sort of communication via sort of email or a briefing to students. The typical one, which is often referenced, is reminding students of the impact that the NSS has on league tables and hence the job prospects of students. Hefke say, you know, that is wrong to do that. But actually, it turns out in 6 cases, staff were suspected of actually having been directly involved in filling in NSS responses themselves. The final thing, just to add, clearly we're talking about allegations here. We can get a bit more information on the seriousness of those allegations, though. Of the 30, 27 investigations had been concluded. Of those, there was insufficient evidence in 6 cases, but 17 cases resulted in institutions being asked to make improvements. And in 4 cases, a panel convened by Hefke judged that the sort of allegations were so serious that it was possible that the course data was unreliable, and therefore those results were suppressed from sources where NSS data is published, like the Unistat's website.
Yeah, so despite, as you say, despite them being allegations, you know, there is a considerable worry within the sector that there is claims of these claims of cheating are actually founded.
Yeah, and I think what this does, it adds to sort of a, you know, some existing questions about the NSS. Mm. There's a phenomenon known as yay-saying, which is a strange phenomenon, but it's actually something that's growing quite rapidly. It's where respondents give the same answer, usually positive, to every question in the NSS. In 2014, 6% of those who completed the NSS online did this, compared to 1% a decade earlier. And also, you've got the recent vote by the National Union of Students to either sabotage or boycott the NSS, or that's what they're hoping to achieve anyway, in protest at the TEF. I spoke to Camille Kentico-Howson, who's a senior lecturer in higher education at King's College London. She says that the growing number of allegations of inappropriate influence is a worrying trend, to quote her, but she also says when you do combine these allegations of inappropriate influence with the question about yay saying, with the NSS boycott, she says that this, you know, combined does raise questions about the overall integrity of the data.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the points drawn out of your piece is obviously something that's become, well, it's been around for a while, since it was first announced by Joe Johnson, and now since the white paper's come out. The NSS data being part of the TEF. Now, this could have serious repercussions if, you know, this cheating, these allegations of cheating were, as suggested in the story, more widespread than just a snapshot, you know.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there's a question, even before we get to, you know, alleged inappropriate influence, about whether being satisfied with your course actually indicates that you've been well taught. I mean, one of the things I hoped to do by looking into this information was perhaps, you know, increase awareness of inappropriate influence and what it is, and perhaps, you know, increase reporting, you know, if there are, you know, genuine cause for concern. One thing that's interesting in that regard is that HEFCE ruled that it wouldn't release the names of the universities involved in these cases, even the ones where you know, it was serious enough that the data had been suppressed, saying that this could, you know, similar talking about individual courses, not whole institutions, that it would have a disproportionate effect on a reputation of an institution, and also that HEFCE relies on institutions effectively to investigate these allegations themselves. HEFCE will only have an independent investigation if it isn't satisfied with that internal investigation. So there was a fear that that would deter institutions from being frank and candid with HEFCE. I mean, I should perhaps just say, finally, I mean, clearly I've spoken to HEFCE about these allegations. A spokesman for HEFCE said, you know, the number of cases where data had been suppressed was very small compared to the hundreds of thousands of students and hundreds of institutions that took part in the NSS each year. I mean, he says that given that HEFCE had received just a handful of allegations each year related to specific courses, to quote him, he says, there's no evidence to suggest that there's a wide-scale problem with inappropriate influence, or that HEFCE's process of investigating allegations is not effective or fit for purpose.
Absolutely. Well, Chris's splash can be found on pages 6 and 7 of the magazine. It's a very interesting story, quite alarming for some, and others might not see it as that alarming. David, you've written the cover feature this week, essentially asking a question: how long will Chinese students, quite often big movers to Western universities, how long will they continue to do so?
Right. Yeah. So, as I'm sure almost all academics listening to this will know, Chinese students have been making up a greater and greater proportion of classes in Western universities. So I think the most recent, in 2015 figures, more than 500,000 went overseas. That's a 13-fold increase since Term Millennium. A lot of universities are very dependent on them. So in 2013 in England, they accounted to 25% of all entrants to full-time taught master's programmes, and that's only 1 percentage point less than UK students accounted for. So although there's still, you know, it's still in the sort of only about 4% in the UK, 7% in Australia, US and France, about 1-2%. I mean, they're still not, you know, absolutely dominating campuses, but they're in certain departments and subjects, they really are. However, as anyone who's been reading the news the past 5 years will know, China's economy is not what it once was. And also it's got an aging demographic. So the feature basically looks at, is this flow that universities have been reliant on, is it going to slow down? What's really interesting actually is looking into this data is, on the demographic front, which is probably the easiest thing to predict. I mean, you can fairly easily predict demographic numbers far better than you can economic ones. To the middle of the century, if you want to look that far ahead, the number of Chinese youngsters of university going age does continue to decline. However, they've already declined quite a bit since 2010, and yet the numbers have still gone up dramatically. So there's kind of been this massive outflow despite a real aging of the population over this. But I mean, it just points to the absolutely massive demand there is for overseas education still. The proportion of Chinese youngsters going overseas is still pretty tiny compared to those who attend university in China. And therefore, you only need to adjust that up, you need to go from, 1-2% or something like that, and you'll still get loads and loads of people coming out of China for their higher education. On the economic side, I guess we don't really know what's going to happen to China's economy, but most people think there's no way back to the, 10%+ GDP growth that we saw in the from the turn of the millennium until the financial crisis. It's all very complicated actually, because a lot of Chinese families will probably have saved for this since their kids were born, or possibly even earlier. They may have bought apartments. The rich ones may have bought apartments and want to sell to fund this. They may have money screwed away overseas. The idea, I think, that the outflows will simply somehow track the fate of the Chinese economy is wrong. There's also, there's the GDP figures in China, not much of it is actually about consumer spending. A lot of it is about the government building, millions of roads and bridges and airports and so on. So, what Chinese families have in their pockets and what the GDP figure is doing is not one and the same thing. However, there are kind of political storm clouds on the horizons in that China's becoming more authoritarian under Xi Jinping. People told me they think, well, who knows, in 5 years' time, it may not be an advantage in China to hold a foreign degree because he might be suspected of being a kind of Western, I don't want to say agent, you're sort of somehow suspect and that the ideas you hold may be politically dangerous. Wow. I think that's probably unlikely given how many of the elite are already, and their kids are already educated abroad. Yeah. But you never know. I mean, what the government started in terms of its authoritarianism and its kind of xenophobic rhetoric, it can spiral rapidly out of control. So who knows? But I think fundamentally the message is that universities in the West are going to have to be better at making Chinese students feel like they have a good time when they come. I mean, so, some people think that there's, it's just a vast mental health crisis among Chinese students overseas. If you treat them well, they'll probably still come. And also, I think Chinese students themselves have a greater role in deciding where to go. It's not just their parents sending off to campuses and courses as it once was. So the onus is on Western universities to treat Chinese students better, I think, and hopefully they'll still come.
Absolutely.
Can I ask, how does this link in with the development of China's own higher education sector? Because clearly, economics and demographics, one thing, but if we talk about the Chinese government, building all these new roads and things, presumably it's also building lots of new universities as well. Is it possible that sort of the home, domestic higher education market is going to be a much better place to cater for Chinese students in coming years?
Yeah, absolutely. Justice in the feature, it may well do. I mean, the demographic decline and the expansion of Chinese higher education means that maybe I think there's a statistic in here that by 2030 or so, there will be a seat for basically every single child in China at a university in you know, 100% enrollment rate. I mean that. Yeah. I mean that's not going to happen. Mm. However, you know, going abroad in a ferociously competitive job market in China, where graduate unemployment is really unclear but pretty serious problem, it may still pay off. And also, by going abroad, you get all kinds of other things. I mean, obviously, you know, social experience, exposure to the outside world. But your family also gets a hook into, you know, the outside world. Mm. I mean, the number, you know, as China becomes more unstable, potentially, you know, the value of having a route to Canadian citizenship or something like that may, as a kind of life raft, potentially, if things go really wrong, may increase. Mm. So it's unclear, but yeah, it's a good point.
Absolutely. Well, David's feature can be found on page 34 of our magazine. There's a lot of stats and data about the flow of Chinese students to Western universities, and presumably some stuff about how many Chinese students are staying home. Matthew, you're going to continue with features. Now, you're going to take us through a piece written by two academics who have suffered physical injury, I suppose is the word, physical complications, which changes, you know, an academic's perspective when we think of academics as living the life in the mind.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, both of them were diagnosed with fairly serious medical problems. I mean, the second piece is by Lawrence, I think it's Sayes, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, who's at SOAS, and he was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. He was not yet 50, so this is obviously a kind of very major life-threatening condition, and which is not going to go away. And so that raised all sorts of issues. It was raised, you know, very obvious issues about who he should talk to about it and so on. Also made him think not only about his own mortality, but whether his work had any kind of continuing relevance, or whether it would kind of die with him, and whether he would be able to produce one last sort of masterly synthesis of all his work to date. The very striking thing is extremely well written, touching pieces, which, you know, are partly about confronting mortality, which I guess is sort of happens to everybody as if they get ill or get older. But he do have a sort of specific academic angle, what it means for an academic as well. I mean, he says he's pretty sure that my experience of cancer will not make me a better person. That there's no nobility in the illness, but he does say that the way he was told that he had cancer was extremely kind of offhand and insensitive, and even a bit patronising. And he thinks that is something which universities, among others, should reflect on. You know, students, you often have to give students bad news of one sort or another, but there's no reason to do it in a way that's insensitive and cruel. And you know, this the other piece is by Martin Paul Eve, who's at Birkbeck. And he is under 30 and had just got his professorship. And he then had major health problems the very next day. He had a stroke arising out of rheumatoid arthritis, which also there were problems with his, significant problems with his eyes. And he found himself, you know, alone in a ward with the sort of antibacterial curtains pulled around him. And insofar as he thought you know, had ever thought about this, things like this might happening to him, he certainly wasn't expecting it to happen in his 20s, and when, as it were, all he'd been working for had just kind of come to pass. And so people often don't talk about illness. So he said, for example, that he didn't know any academics who had had strokes and continued to work. And obviously, he says very nice things about his employers, but obviously, if you are incapacitated to perform your job functions, could lose your job. So it wasn't impossible that you might die. So very major things he had to confront much earlier in his life than he ever expected. And both of them say that they were very, very pleasantly surprised by the response of friends and colleagues who kind of were very supportive, and you know, hope that they will make them equally sensitive to other people suffering from similar things. If somebody, because it is very, if somebody suddenly tells you they've got a terminal disease or a major health problem, it is often very hard to react. So they're both very, very striking pieces about something we perhaps don't think and talk about enough.
No, quite. I agree. That was my what I took from it. Obviously, we talk to academics all the time, and academics talk to us all the time, and they talk about their work. We don't sometimes detach ourselves from this obvious that the academics are people, and you know, they're not superheroes. They have the same frailties that everyone else has, and we don't often hear about it. It's a fantastic couple of pieces, and can be found on page 42 of our magazine. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for in this week's issue review podcast. But of course, if you'd like to comment on any of the matters discussed or any of the content within the magazine, you can contact us via all manner of social media, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, of course, and on our website, timeshighereducation.com. Until next week's issue review podcast, though, I wish you goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.